there, folks, and welcome to Christ in Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with Dr. John Seleska, Director Emeritus of the Concordia Bible Institute, and me, Dr. Brian Gurman, Assistant Professor of Theology here at the University and the current Director of the Bible Institute. Dr. Seleska has had a long career as a parish pastor, college and seminary professor, and he's known for highlighting how central Christ is throughout the entire Bible, Christ in every word, as our tagline puts it. So it's an honor to be with him here in the podcast room and learn a little bit more from him about the book of 2 Samuel, and I believe we're now on chapter 20.
We are, in fact, at chapter 20. We need to review a little bit to be sure that we can lead into this chapter and the next, which is a very different chapter where we talk about a Rizpah, a concubine who had two children. And it's an interesting story because it does show the love of a mother for her sons. But getting back to chapter 19, where David has won the victory over his son, and we spent a little time in analyzing what that means, that here is his son, whom he had befriended throughout his lifetime, given him every advantage of as being the son of the king. This son then determines to take the kingdom from his own father and rule. And I think I remarked about that's what's hidden in the hearts of all of us, every child born into this world is selfish, self-centered, self-serving, self-indulgent, is curved in on himself, as Luther says, in curvatus se, that Latin phrase which he often used to describe what we are like. It's all about us. That's how we are, and that cannot be changed. It can be hemmed in. We say that the law acts as a curb, but what's hidden there is still there. And I do think it's incumbent on every father with every one of his children to, in some sense, have to break the child's will. Otherwise, that child will rule and he will be incorrigible unless someone curbs it. And we see in this society, without fathers often in families, that there's no one with the strength and the understanding of what's right and wrong to establish himself in the family as the one who is the ruler, the king, if you will, and the son or the child will become a tyrant. And that's, of course, what happened here. I'm sure that this young man, Absalom, had every advantage, but a father who probably was too indulgent with him. He was a beautiful child. And, you know, if you compliment someone too much, he takes it to heart, begins to believe it, and I guess in Absalom's case, of course, it went way to his heart, and it ruled and governed him. This is the spirit of disarray. This really, we haven't talked too much about this, but we ought to, because we mentioned it when we got to Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, earlier with John when we were doing this, that's a very important verse. I will put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, thou shalt bruise his heel. I'm going to get you. I'm going to crush your head. And for the devil at this point already with David, these times are desperate. We've simply got to begin to somehow establish our kingdom and our rule. And what better way than undermining the, quote, messianic king? That would be David here, of course, because if we can do that, if we can get this whole nation, Israel, and its king in disarray and disorder, we will begin to conquer. We'll begin to win. And if you just stand back from what's happening in our own world, you can see that that is an attempt by really in every culture and ours too, but it's hemmed in more. It's curbed a little more in our society than it is around the world. But otherwise, it would be complete chaos. There would be no stopping people. It would be whoever the strongest man is, the last man standing rules. It's how we are. I realize that human beings by nature don't like to admit that, and we don't like to admit that we're, quotes, all little Absaloms. But the truth of the matter is that this is the one who, quotes, rules in the hearts of human beings, if it isn't the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of our Lord, if he doesn't rule, then it's this other spirit who is determined somehow to avoid what that promise in Genesis chapter 3 and onward in with Abraham and the patriarchs, Jacob and so forth, all the way down the line. He has to undermine this because otherwise his very existence is at stake. And we see that then working out here. Now David has won the battle in this instance. He's returning from Jordan to Jerusalem, and he's met by the people who had, of course, gone out to meet him as he fled. And you recall that one of them was Shimei, who cursed and threw stones at him. Now Shimei comes in abject penitent, saying, "Please, I'm sorry of what I did. Don't take my life." And David, and I think I mentioned this also, now knows he's ruling over a kingdom of rebels. We'll see that again in the next chapter. Chapter 20, when we get to that, we'll see that he's ruling over rebels. And even though he's won the battle, it's not over. It's not over for David. It isn't over for Israel. And of course, it isn't over for God's people. And we ought to keep that in mind also as we battle the prince of the powers of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the children of disobedience. So then he's on his way back, and there is this kind of turmoil occurring between the tribe of Judah and the rest of Israel. And they go back and forth, the tribe of Israel claiming they had 10 parts in this king. Mm-hmm. Judah, of course, claiming, I guess, louder, more vociferously, but I think also they had the power with them. David, of course, was still king in the eyes of the people. So that resided with the tribe of Judah, and Judah sort of won out. If you look at that last verse, I'm not sure how it reads in your
Yeah, in the Bible. ESV, it just has the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel.
Yeah, and we puzzled about that last time, and I'm not real sure how to understand it, except that evidently they had the power behind them. That is, if their words conveyed what powers and authority in David and his people, if that was behind the words of the men of Judah, then perhaps they just had Israel probably had to concede. And I think we'll find to some degree that's true in that next chapter. But that does take us to the end of chapter 19 and leads us into then our study for today. And so immediately, David is on his way back. People are meeting him. I didn't mention Barzillai, this nice man, but he's old and he had fed the troops of David as they fled. And he comes back out, and David offers him a place in his kingdom, but he's too old, he says, to go. He could be of no help to David.
80 years old.
80 years old, right. It's interesting.
A very aged man, 80 years old.
Yeah. And they said old there, but, you know, sometimes when they're old, they're not old. Like Abraham was old, but not old when he had a child.
Yeah, that's right.
So we're not real sure what old means.
Moses was climbing mountains.
Yes. These were sturdy people, to be honest. Right. So then this rebellion again. Here is Sheba. Now it just says in the King James, a son of Belial. Mm. That means a worthless rogue. I don't know. What does your translation say?
Yeah, that's how the ESV does it. There happened to be there a worthless man.
A worthless man. Yeah, he's...
But Belial, yeah, it's, Belial would yeah, probably
it
be
seems
literal.
Almost too gentlemanly. He's got a little devil in him. You know, you say that about children once in a while. And we mean it. They sometimes do things that aren't real good. But this guy had a little bit more in mind. So he says, what inheritance do we have in the son of David, Jesse's son? David, Jesse's son, I assume, I'm not real sure they realized it was Judah. That whole scuffle or whatever it was that had begun before between Israel and Judah, they recognized, I guess, that in terms of inheritance and the power and the glory, it rested with Judah. We know that passage from Genesis 49,
right.
The scepter shall not depart from Judah. So I assume that maybe they held something like that up against Israel. This is us. We're about the Messiah, God's chosen one who will come, all of that perhaps. But nevertheless, you see, we don't have any inheritance. to your tents, O Israel. And the now in the King James verse 1 says, all Israel joined this guy. What does yours say?
In verse 2, so all the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now, this, and then also adds that the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from the Jordan.
Yeah, see, they stayed there. So the dispute probably dissolves into something obviously more desperate again in the kingdom, because all of Israel is gone and they're following Sheba and they think he's going to rule. Okay, if we don't have any inheritance in Judah and the son of Jesse, David, then we'll go out on our own. And so...
would this be the ten tribes then?
I assume, is that right?
So it would be Judah and Benjamin that are in
well,
the south?
Well, no, this is Benjamin. Look at verse 1.
This is Benjamin, that's right. So this is the 11 then.
Yeah. We do know the two tribes, the two southern tribes as Judah and Benjamin, and yet here is this Benjamin. This Benjamin, you know, we way back in the book of Judges, I think it's chapter 9 or so in the book of Judges, where we have this Levite with his concubine coming into the city of the Benjamites.
That's right.
They want to commit homosexual acts with him.
19.
And then the rest of Israel comes after them, and they defend themselves. And these homosexuals, they defend this. Their tribe was almost wiped out, if you recall, that instance. So this is not a rebellious tribe. These are not really nice people at all. Mm-hmm. Well, here they are again, causing trouble in Israel.
Saul's tribe.
Yeah. Well, I think it's in verse 3 then where David, the concubines, the ten concubines that he left behind to take care of the palace when he began to take flight from Absalom, he puts them in ward. I don't know how it says it here. He just sort of separated them, segregated
them. Put them in a house and provided for them. Yeah, under guard.
Yeah.
And provided for them.
He just provided for them. He gave them the victuals, I suppose, the food and the clothing and whatever they needed. But he no longer had sexual relations with them so that they can become mothers. They remained in widowhood, or they remained widows, really. Simply because of what had happened, you recall, with Absalom. Absalom had been the one who had had relations with him on top of the roof under the sun so that everybody could see this. And so David, I suppose, assumed from that these are now what would you say, benighted in the eyes of the other tribes that he no longer recognized them as, quote, secondary wives, and I don't think he wanted Israel either to see them as such because of what had happened, that whole ugly affair with Absalom. That takes care of that for the point, not for the time being, but now we do have to deal with Sheba and that rebellion. And it's interesting. Now, if you would go back to chapter 19, I think it's verse 13, where David does an interesting thing. I believe I mentioned it, but I think we need to mention it here again because it plays into what occurs now.
And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also if you are not commander of my army from now on in the place of Joab.
Aha. Uh-huh. Now we know that Joab had been insubordinate, that he had violated a specific command. And, you know, all the people had heard that command. All the people knew what Joab had done. So he's in disfavor. He's no longer the favorite fighter for David. He's no longer commander in chief. You think. It's interesting what rebellion does in the lives of people and how it asserts itself also in this man. Now, he had fought a lot of nice fights, battles for David. And he was Zeruiah, son of Zeruiah. Abishai is his brother. Asahel is the one that Abner had run through, if you'll remember, way back there. But these two are still brothers, and they're working together. And Joab just could care less about Amasa. He was having nothing to do with that order by David that Amasa should now go and gather together the people to fight against Sheba. And Amasa took too long It took him too long to gather them together. So Abishai was sort of commissioned at this point. I don't know what David was thinking. He knew what the relationship was between Joab and Abishai, brothers. Nevertheless, it's Abishai. And then when they get, is this verse 8, where they get to the rock, some huge rock of some sort.
Yeah, a great stone in the ESV, yeah. Verse 8.
Mm-hmm. And they come to that stone, and that's where now Joab and Amasa comes, and Joab appears. So Joab now somehow, wherever he was at this point, now appears on the scene as they take off after Sheba, this rebel who's supposedly going to take Israel to the point where they'll capture, I suppose, Jerusalem and take over the kingdom. I'm not sure what was in the mind. That's not told us, but we do know that he wanted to control. He wanted to rule because that's indicated initially as he rebels against David. So here we have Joab joining. And now you just have to wonder. This is his cousin. Amasa is his cousin. Mm-hmm. Zeruiah is David's sister who gave birth to Joab and Abishai. Abigail is another sister of David who gave birth to Amasa. So they're cousins. Joab appears on the scene and it's kind of, it just staggers your imagination to wonder what's going through his mind, aside from the fact that he says, I'm captain of the forces. I don't care what David said. This is the kind of rebellious spirit that exists in the hearts of these guys. Also, there's this sort of, what would you say, internecine, a battle going on in a battle. Hmm. Who's going to win this? Anyway, here it is. Joab appears. He's in battle garb. I'm not sure.
Yeah, soldier's garment. He's and over it was garment. A belt with a sword and its yeah. sheath fastened on his thigh.
Yeah. Okay. Now.
And forward it fell out.
It fell. Now, it says that fell out. In one of the translations, I wondered what that meant. It just fell out. Well, obviously, Amasa would have seen that.
Yeah.
But he evidently didn't. It didn't. It says he failed to take note of that sword. So it looks as if it fell into his hand. And one of the translations does say that, not all. Hmm. But one says it fell right into his hand, almost as if by design. Maybe it was, you know how, okay. I've got it here. It'll yeah. fall into my, it'll just fall into my left hand, I guess. Because he put out his right hand to embrace Amasa. Amasa didn't, verse 10, I think, he failed to see the sword.
That's right.
And then what happens?
Joab strikes him.
Strikes him. And it says, no, I won't have to do this more than once. You've heard that before. Yeah, now right. Here it is, only one time.
Right.
And his bowels gushed out. I don't know what yours says.
Yeah,
but that's
entrails.
How,
yep.
That's how it says it in the King James. Bowels gushed out. There he is. And then, as the other soldiers pass by, it says he wallowed in his blood on the road. Yeah. Well, you know, that's sort of how would you call that kind of activity? He's shuddering, shaking, quaking, whatever sort of activity would occur under those circumstances. I mean, he's mortally wounded. He's demonstrating that. And now a young man sees this, he stops. And then the other people begin to stop also. They all passing by stop. So this man who saw Amasa wallow there in his own blood says this. I mean, is that about verse 12 where he says, mm-hmm. Will those who are after Joab and David follow? Really follow Joab, because that's Joab is really fighting for David.
Right.
You follow him. And, of course, they all stand there like they're all stunned. I don't think they could believe what happened. They knew the relationship, surely, and that he would do such a thing. I mean, he was the leader also. He had been told to gather together an army for David. There he is. So, what to do? How to get, the soldiers, I think, are just stunned. They don't know who to follow. There is this vacillating on their part, what to do, where to go, who to follow. And so the young man just takes Amundsen, takes him into a field, covers him up, and then they move on.
Wow.
Now, as you look at that, you think, boy, it's hard to know how to deal with these people or how they deal with one another. This is a sad episode in the history of David's reign, but there it is, and it's something that did happen, and not a whole lot of commentary given to it, interestingly. Mm-hmm. They just move on.
Wow.
And somewhere, David will have to, I don't know if David will have to tell his sister. Somebody will have to go back and say, look, this is what happened.
That's right.
Anyway.
Yeah, and on that note, we should probably
stop. Okay, that's
we'll think about that.
Not a real pleasant place to...
That's right, but we'll be right back after a quick pause.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website, www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcast, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
Alrighty there, folks. We are back with our study of 2 Samuel, this time chapter 20, and Amasa has just been slain, and they took his body into the field and threw a garment over him. When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the part at which we left you, and we hope we didn't leave you wallowing in something, but it just is a sad scene that you imagine when you listen to that, because here's a man dying. And wiggling and wriggling and whatever happens under those circumstances, people are watching. I'm sure puzzled and in pain themselves to see this kind of life and death struggle that's going on for him. He's taking his last breaths and trying, of course, somehow to perhaps even justify what's going on in his own mind. What happened? He didn't realize what Joab had in mind and what he was going to do, but Joab was going to rule if it took murder to bring that to pass, and which is of course what happened. But now they're going after Sheba, and they come to this is it Abel, a city called Abel,
Abel of Beth Maaca,
Beth. Well, in the King James, it's pronounced Beth Maaca. So I'm doing King James pronunciations. And they're going to take it. I mean, they've now sort of surrounded, I suppose. They're building up a ramp that's as high as the outer wall, I think it says. And then there's a wise woman. Now, that takes us back also, doesn't it? Way back to Judges, yeah. I think that's chapter 9, too.
Right.
Abimelech.
That's right.
Abimelech, and a woman drops a millstone on his head. And David reminded Joab of that one at that whole battle when he had committed adultery and told Joab to let Uriah up in the front lines. And he admonished him initially. And they said, well, Uriah, your servant Uriah is dead. Oh, well, David said, now that he's out of the way. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's what happened there. Now we have a wise woman here, and she sort of, she says, she calls, send me Joab. And Joab comes and she asks him, are you Joab? Yes, he answers, I'm Joab. Well, they negotiate. She does not want the city destroyed, which is what he probably would have done. He would have destroyed that city to get at Sheba. It would have been the, you know, the best way in which to deliver this young man, I guess, back to David. But David had initially said, when Amasa didn't return, he said, you know, this has got to be taken care of because this Sheba is going to be worse than Absalom if we don't get him before he gets into towns, take some of the really strongholds and strong towns, and then we'll really have a problem on our hands. So that's why David, I think, dismissed what happened between Joab and Amasa. But anyway, so the woman said, okay, we'll deal with him. All I want, Joab said, is Sheba. All I want is Sheba. We won't do anything if you'll hand out to us Sheba. She says, okay. She went in and negotiated with the town leaders, and they decided, let's just behead him. We'll throw the head out. David will recognize the face, I suppose. Again, very grisly, but the true circumstances. So they threw the head over the wall, I guess, and Joab saw it, called the troops together and called them away, and they went back. But they, of course, won the battle, and that was the end of that rebellion. Wow. And that man had learned his lesson the hard way. And then at the end, there's a little chunk of verses. It talks about who is in charge of the forces. Mm-hmm. Joab.
That's right.
Benaiah. I don't know if you want to go through all the different facets of government. It might be interesting. I don't know your translations.
Sure.
But
I can, yeah,
just those last verses.
Sure. Now, Joab was in command of all the army of Israel, as you said. And then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the Cherethites and the Pelethites.
Right.
And Adoram was in charge of the forced labor. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder. And Sheva was secretary. And Zadok and Abiathar were priests. And Ira and Jairite was also David. Oh, sorry, Ira the Jairite was also David's priest.
Priest, yeah. And so it shows an organization in his whole kingdom. These are the people who were in his cabinet, we probably would say today.
Sure.
And since he was a man of war, and that's why he wouldn't be permitted to build the temple, but it also does show that he knew what he was doing. It wasn't disorganized. It wasn't a disarray sort of thing with David. He had this pretty much in hand. And all of these people are very important people, so that he would discuss various aspects of the kingdom with these. And, of course, then the spiritual leaders, too, are there. Zadok and Abiathar are there as a priest. So you realize he still is a very spiritual man. Despite all the things that had happened, he still was in, I'm sure, contact with God, because we'll find that out now. Chapter 21 will help us to do that. Mm-hmm. And this is that interesting story I talked about, and very poignant. It's the pathos here is one which I want to deal with for you, so that you realize that the effect of some of these battles and some of the deaths would have on the loved ones. You know, it's almost as if they're dismissed. Mm-hmm. You don't hear anything about that in that last chapter, or here's a brother, a cousin, a son, dead, and you just don't hear anything at all about what happened when the news went back. Hmm. But here we have this event. Now, it says that there was a famine in the land for three and a half years.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at the time here, and I'm wondering if maybe you want to just maybe introduce
okay.
it, and then, because we probably won't have much time, more than just another minute or two to get into it.
We're that
it. So,
far along.
Yeah, so again, time flies when you're having fun.
Time.
But if you wanted to introduce it for the...
I'll introduce it. This is, there's a famine, and the reason is that the covenant which Joshua had made with the Gibeonites way back...
Oh.
You remember that covenant where they came in with dry That's bread right. and food and old clothes and so forth, and he entered into a covenant. He didn't require anything from the Lord. He didn't ask of the Lord then as to what he should do with these people who had come. He just entered the covenant because he believed they were from a far country. It wouldn't be a problem.
Was that hewers of stone and drawers of water?
Yes, they got to be hewers of stone, drawers of water. That's correct. That's correct.
That's right.
And so they were always that until this point. And then Saul enters the picture, and he didn't like the fact that they were living among the Israelites. He wanted to wipe them out. They weren't Jews. They weren't supposed to be here. I don't know. I'm sure he must have known of the covenant, the treaty which had been made between them way back with Joshua, and how important a treaty would. They gave their word. These were the Israelites no matter what, and they refused to deal with the Gibeonites, which they might have done when they lied and deceived. But they didn't. They kept their part. But not Saul. And now David, here's where I say, David's still a very spiritual man. He inquires of the Lord. I'll leave you with that question. What did he do when he required of the Lord? Where did he go? I think to some degree what is mentioned in those last verses where it talks about the priests in his kingdom, and in some sense he must have asked advice or counsel from them about this famine. Why are we having a famine? Why is the Lord seemingly punishing us? What have we done? And then he's told. And this shows how important the word of the Israelites was from the past. And Joshua, their leader, that the Lord wanted them to abide by that covenant. You gave your word, don't break your word. If you make an oath, keep it. Proverbs, you know that passage in Proverbs.
That's right.
You make an oath, keep it.
Right.
Well, is that about?
Well,
that's an introduction.
That's probably a good place to stop. But this is a very intriguing chapter. Though,
it will be, and we want you to come back, people. Don't.
That's right.
Don't take next Wednesday. Don't. Are we here next Wednesday?
We're here next Wednesday.
Okay.
Yep, that's right. So
don't take a vacation.
That's right.
Wait till June.
Well, that's all the time that we have for this session of Christ in Every Word, but please consider mentioning this to your family and friends that they too can learn more about God's Word with us. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. Again, if you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting the Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on our Contribute page. Until next time, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman, here today with Dr. John Seleska, wishing you God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.